Accession number 27460, reel 26.
Mr. Wilkes, reel 26. Mail, how often was that coming through to you?
Mail? Spasmodically. Sometimes you got quite a lot, and then you'd go quite a few days without any.
And in reverse, you're getting mail out. Was that a reasonable situation?
If we had time to write it, we invariably did get it away.
And what was the procedure?
Oh, we handed it into the regimental office, and then they sent it back, because the ration wagon was one vehicle that was always going back down the line for supplies, so it could always take the mail back.
And you'd be censored, of course.
Yes, it was censored. And I'm pleased to say that I must have been a good lad. I never put anything in that should not have been in. Nothing that I ever sent home was ever cut out, amended, or anything like that.
How important is mail to the soldier?
Very, very, very important. It's very demoralising when you go a long time and no mail is coming, and you don't know what's happening in this country. I suppose I had to talk to one or two chaps whose marriages went wrong, and I wasn't as old as them, but I think my upbringing gave me my morals, and I was able to resort to those to give them a bit of guidance on coping.
Yeah, comrades like that, to people like that, must be very important, because it's so many miles away, you can't get back. There's no way you're going to be returned to sort things out.
That's right.
And it must have been a dreadful situation.
It was a terrible situation. You just felt that you really were the forgotten army.
And I say comrades, them, someone to talk to.
Yes.
And support them in a way was very important.
Well, two men in particular that I talked to, both of them, they'd been married a while. One had a child, and I think they both had, actually, if my memory serves me right. But on each occasion, I wasn't brought in directly, but through friends of theirs. One of them, he was on my post at one stage, and he was a jolly good worker normally, but everything had gone wrong. And so his friend said to me, he said... I said to his friend, I said, what's the matter with Valla? And, he said, he's got family problems. His wife's gone off with a naval officer. So, I said, he can't complain. I said, he hasn't been behaving himself here. He said, I wish you'd have a word with him and tell him that. He says, I daren't. Because his friend was no better.
Yes, it's the other side of the coin, because they may have been naughty boys.
That's right. And so, on that particular occasion, I had a talk with him, and I said, be reasonable. I said, give it a lot of thought, and don't say, she's done wrong. Say, we've done wrong. And now, how can we put it right? Well, actually, just before we got to Rangoon, he'd was taken out. He'd applied for compassionate leave, etc., and he was flown home. And just before we got home, his friend had got a letter from him saying that all was well, he'd adopted the child, that's this officer's child, and him and his wife had patched everything up, and he would treat the child as his own. So that was one that worked out satisfactorily.
So there was the facility of being flown out if the situation warranted it. They would let you go.
Yes, but it had been nearly a year.
So where are you now then? We've got to Mandalay. What happened to you there?
Yes, well, we're going down these two valleys one at a time and dodging about. And I was just going to tell you how my vehicle broke down. Now, I had kept this vehicle going without proper spare parts, and I could not get them. And it was something I couldn't do much about. The fuel pipes were flexible pipes. And I'd had to wrap them with insulation tape and cement, engine cement. And I kept it going. And of course, this particular day, the blessed thing would fail, and we were not supposed to leave the vehicle, not supposed to stay, remain and repair it. However, the light aid detachment came along, and they would take me on tow. And so we were going down a very, very steep descent, across a narrow bit in the bottom, and then a steep ascent, and a sheer drop over either side. And this chap missed his gears as we started the climb up the other side. Snatched, broke the tow bar, and which spun the Bren carrier round, and was heading to go straight over the precipice side. Now, because I wasn't needed to steer the vehicle, because it was steered by the A-bar, which had now broken, I leapt back into the driver's seat, and the steering wheel was what you steered the vehicle. It acted on the brakes. And I pulled it as hard as I could and slewed the vehicle. It was hanging over the precipice edge, but it was standing there. And the RSM, who'd been following in a jeep and trailer, he thought it was remarkable that we'd survived. But the other men that were on the carrier, they jumped off at that stage. And I said to them, why the hell didn't you jump when I said? I said, well, if you were going to stop and we knew you'd be safe. But I think that was just after the event they were content. I don't think they felt like jumping.
So you had your hairy moments, the moments of danger that you personally were in.
That's right. So we managed to keep hold of the vehicle and attached the winch and chocked it, and we eventually managed to make a temporary repair to the A-bar, and they took me on tow again. So we got to a position that evening where we had to cross a dried up river bed, which was all sand, and of course this blessed big Mack that was towing me, as soon as we got in the soft sand, his front wheels splayed out and we were stuck. And just for good measure, one of our batteries, I think it was 522, had got shelled as they were crossing this particular patch. So we had to move fairly smartly. Well, of course, the big Mack dug its wheels in right down to the axles, and I was stuck. So while we were stuck, I rigged up an emergency petrol tank out of a petrol tin and got it coupled straight into the petrol pump and got the engine running. In the meantime, they got plenty of planks and jacked the big Mack up, and they had to take the track rod off, straighten it and weld angle iron onto it to stiffen it up a bit. It already had one piece of angle iron on that had bent, and now it had two pieces on. And so when we were ready to move, with me being able to push, and the wheels on planks, we all got moving, and we crossed this riverbed and got into our position for the night.
Did every vehicle carry with it the means of getting out of problems like that? In other words, spare timber or what have you?
No, no. The light aid detachment had plenty. The guns, the gun wagons, the tractors, they had so much what we called skidding that they used to carry. It had served two purposes, because when we were in a position, they could stack the ammunition on it, and to keep it, the ammunition off the ground. So there was always plenty of that around. But for the lighter vehicles, there was nothing.
And you were moving down tracks, you said, not roads. It must have been pretty hard going.
Everything was hard going, yes.
The vehicles, the actual stress on the vehicles must have been tremendous.
It was. Now, at one point, we were making for a place called Keoxy. And I remember I noticed that the clutch was starting to slip on the Bren carrier. Now, I never ride a clutch, ever, but the tough going and the hard work, it was causing the clutch to slip. And I had a method of driving this vehicle where I never used the clutch. I could change gears without using the clutch at all, apart from starting. And so we got to Keoxy, and I reported. I knew that job was too big for me to tackle. So the Warrant Officer Class 2 that was in charge of our light aid detachment at this stage, he didn't agree with me. He said the clutch wasn't slipping. So I was left with it. But a few days later, when we came to move, the clutch was slipping. I couldn't get very far. I got 2 miles down the road and that was it. So we went back to the position where they were waiting for a jeep engine to be dropped by parachute. And then they agreed with me that the clutch was slipping. So while we were there, Keoxy was a place that while we were there before the main party moved out, we got encircled. The Japanese surrounded us, and whereas we thought it was just platoon or company strength that would clear the Japs, I think it was more than tanks and battalions to get them moved. It took all day to open the road again.
And this was ahead of you, was it?
That was behind us.
Yeah, well, yes, around you, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And
which was a Japanese tactic, wasn't it?
Yes, that was their method. So I know there was a stream, a chong, running down there, and they were doing some washing of clothes this particular afternoon, and then someone shouted, "Japs!" Well, we always kept our weapons on the beach at the side, rushed, but the Japs were all dead. There was 8 of them coming floating down, bloated, bah, what a size. And someone said, "Oh, the Gurkhas have had them." But anyway, the thing was, they went sailing down, but we were getting our drinking water out of that chong further down, and they were washing mules in it. But anyway, it was while we were there, it was after the main body had moved out and I was busy fitting a new clutch, because I had to do it. And we got the they would get the parts. I was stripping the engine out so we could get on with the job. And this night there would be a film show, and I always remember it was Bette Davis in Now Voyager. And we saw that film. And for all the Japanese had been so close to us, and it wasn't a closed cinema, it was just a screen rigged up and you could sit either side of it and hear the talk. It was all open air, very friendly.
Did you get visits from entertainers at any time?
Yes.
Spencer, for example?
Yes, down, I think it was near Mandalay, and I think this particular occasion is mentioned in General Slim's book. So many of us that were in close proximity, there was this Enza party had come, and I can remember that among the entertainers was a Cherry Lind and Forsyth, Seaman and Farrell. They were amongst it. And this was in a marquee. And when we went in, we were all carrying our petrol tins to sit on. We saw this two rows of camp chairs along in front of the stage. We thought, who are these for? We've wasted our time bringing these tins, but we were told they weren't for us. And it turned out General Slim and his entourage, who had been right forward that afternoon, had thought they'd come and have a nice evening's entertainment until the interval. So they sat down and we were thoroughly enjoying the show, and when the interval came, the main party got up and they only got to the entrance of the marquee and they all turned round and came back and sat down. Well, when we were setting off to go back to our units, we were warned the Japanese had surrounded us while we were in, and but they'd been cleared, and we had to be very careful because Japs could be lurking in lots of places as we went back to our units. So we were careful, but we never encountered anything. And General Slim does make mention of this in his book.
Did you ever meet him?
Not personally. But mind you, I've met his son not so long ago.
How was he held by the troops?
I think if you sum him up as Uncle Bill, I think you had, that was it.
Very
high regard, yes. He was a soldier's man. He was a soldier's soldier. I don't think he would ever ask his men to do anything that he wasn't capable of leading them into.
Did you meet any other of the higher ranks?
Not as such. The CCRA was about the nearest we got, I think. I know some of the generals did come around. We did see the generals on occasions, but I never got in close proximity.
So how far are you off Rangoon by now?
Oh, we're still a long way. Kioxi. As I say, the following day, after we'd seen this film, I finished putting the engine back in and getting everything ready. The Jeep engine had been dropped by parachute, and eventually we were ready to set off. And one of our Royal Artillery officers had remained behind with us, and we would set off. And we travelled along the road a while, and then one of my bogies began to burn off. And I checked it, and I thought we'd carry on a bit further, so it was agreed we'd carry on till we got to some camouflage. And when we got there, lo and behold, there was an abandoned Japanese gun with all the dead Japs laid out around it. So they'd been dispatched, probably by Gurkhas, we thought. We changed the bogey wheel, and at the same time we had some lunch, and then pushed on. And in the afternoon, as we were travelling along, we met someone coming in the opposite direction in a truck. And there were two men in it, and there seemed to be an awful panic, and they stopped us and said there was a sniper way up ahead, and pointed to where the sniper was. was supposed to be. So our officer immediately summoned my truck and my Bren carrier up to the front, and we planted a machine gun on it, and I followed his jeep. And at a certain point, he pointed where I had to stop and give them cover while they got past. But I was never needed. They just tagged on to the end of the column again and went on.
So there was no sniper?
If there was, I think he knew we were alerted and he wasn't going to sacrifice himself.
Well, they were quite a number of these were only dangers, aren't they, the snipers that were left behind?
That's right, so, yes.
Okay. Which you had to be aware of all the time.
Yes. So now we were pushing on to a place called Prome. And I remember we were 80 miles from Prome when we were told it was 80 miles. And they were hoping to get there in a week. And that was the rate of advance. Now, at this stage, we were moving with the tanks. And it was a case of moving about 10 miles every day. And invariably, the Japanese would leave an anti-tank gun. And that would knock out the first tank. And we would dispatch the anti-tank gun. And that was... We got to Prome, and regimental headquarters took over a big house on top of a hill, looking down into Prome. When we got there, the chap that was driving the water wagon told me that he was experiencing problems, which I quickly recognised as water in the petrol. And he said there's just one problem. He had to be down in Prome to the water point to get water, and there wasn't much time. So I grabbed my toolkit, put it in the truck, and we went down in the truck into Prome, and it was getting dark by now. And all these troops are milling about. I suddenly realised they were Indian, they weren't dressed in uniforms as we expected. And they were actually these Japanese Imperial Free Forces, GIFs, as we called them. So while I was working on the wagon, I was doing various jobs. We were moving closer and closer to the well to get the water. And these lot were milling about. There were so many, I thought they could disarm us at a moment. I hung on to my Sten gun. And we carried on and got the work on his truck done, and we got away. But I think they were just glad to have surrendered.
And they were unarmed, were they, at that point?
They were unarmed, they'd been disarmed. And, of course, when we got back, we were told that they'd been disarmed. We hadn't been told before we went.
So these were members of the so-called Indian National Army?
Yes.
And that was the first time you'd come across them?
That I had, yes.
And they obviously hadn't been put into any form of camp at all, of prison camp?
They hadn't had time. We'd just taken the place that day, and I think they'd been left behind to defend Prome. And, well, of course, the British had taken it. We were rushing on at that speed, and so... Prome, we were there for a few days before we moved on. Our guns were moving forward, but it was a few days before the main body of headquarters moved on.
Again, do you know what date this would be?
I can't remember, no.
So where did you go to after that, then?
After we moved so far down the road from Prome towards Rangoon. And it was down the road there that we met up with the invasion force that had landed near Rangoon. They were coming up the road to meet us, and we met up. And then after we'd done that, we pulled back into Prome for a short while. And then by then, now the monsoon was breaking and We're getting some real wet weather. We set off, and yes, at this stage we'd pulled back to Prome, and we were there to prevent Japanese getting across from the west, crossing the Irrawaddy. Prome stands on the Irrawaddy, and they were attempting to get back from the west across the Irrawaddy with their intention of getting across to the Shan Hills and to the Shan States. Well, there was a Chong that ran down. Headquarters was now right beside the Irrawaddy, and I was given a position on the corner where the Irrawaddy went past and this Chong flowed out into the Irrawaddy. There was an infantry unit on the opposite corner, and they used to be watching the Japanese building rafts. The Irrawaddy was about 2 miles wide there, and they used to watch them building rafts, and then during the evening, when they used to try and get across, the infantry used to mortar them, and then you heard them in the water shouting and screaming.
And you were witness to this? You witnessed all this?
We heard it all, yes.
Had you any sympathy with Japanese in this situation, being killed in the way they were?
No. None at all. I think I had no feeling for them. I could be quite brutal to one of them if one had come across my path.
Was their reputation towards prisoners and
yes,
and it was well known.
And we used to hear these terrible stories coming up. So we stayed there for a while, and then we moved from Prome into Rangoon. And when we got to Rangoon, we heard that Lord Louis Mountbatten had praised the tanks for getting their old tanks down to Rangoon, and he said they can push them into the sea now if and we'll get some fresh ones, but there it was. So what did we do? Well, the first thing, we had some guns in position at the Satang Bend, I understand. I think 4 guns were there. The rest of the regiment was in a situation of rest and repair. And so that was what we were doing. We did have an ENSA party come there as well. And I know it was whilst we were there, we heard the great news that the war was finished. I remember I was sound asleep this night on the veranda of the billet I had. It was just a native building. And someone came and woke me up, and we could hear the cheering down in Rangoon itself. We were a little bit out of the town. And so the following day,
what was your immediate feelings on hearing this news?
Relief in a way, but couldn't quite comprehend, couldn't believe it. I just turned over and went back to sleep, and woke up with new feelings the following morning.
And what was happening what was going on around you? As you say, there was cheering out, but was there a moment for celebrating this huge event?
No, it was, as far as we were concerned, it was a normal day. Now then, while we'd been in this position, there was another chap in headquarters who operated what was called a 19 set, a radio set. And he and I had been chosen to go into an out-of-bounds area to negotiate and exchange tins of pilchards and tins of corned beef for fresh eggs. And so this particular day, they wanted some. The only problem was the other man that operated the 19 set was on leave. So they couldn't send this other chap, so the adjutant asked me if I thought I could go by myself. And I said I could, and I did. But then I was subjected to Chinese hospitality.